All right, welcome to class today. I hope you all can hear me and so forth. I see we have just over half the class in attendance, which is about what I expected. Hopefully, if you all can see my mouth moving but not hear me, sooner or later somebody will say something in the chat. We will do our best to adjust to this peculiar delivery mechanism. If at any point you would like to make a comment, you are welcome to do so either by unmuting yourself and just speaking to interrupt me, or by using the raise your hand feature in the participant list in Zoom, or by typing something in the Zoom chat. Any of those ways will work out okay. So, I guess before we begin, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? That is correct. One computer is broadcasting and the other one is monitoring chats and so forth. Anything else? All right. Then where should we go first? Let's go to talk about our quiz. So we had a quiz. And this quiz, we did pretty well on. Let me just talk about a few of the odds and ends that were going on here. I decided to award some half credit for things. I haven't done that much in the past. But anyway, we mostly understood that if x divides y, then the greatest common divisor is x. So hopefully that will, hopefully that makes general sense. I also awarded partial credit if you knew it was the other one, but because x is a divisor of y, its largest divisor is itself. And therefore the greatest common divisor is also itself. If the least common multiple, if it divides y, the least common multiple is the other value, okay? Because the least common multiple is the smallest number that has both numbers as a factor, and since one is a factor of the other, the larger one is the least common multiple. We were almost universally correct in relating the greatest common divisor and least common multiples. When it got to this set of things that divide things, I awarded half credit for the answer that makes things if you're thinking only of the prime factors. So if instead of all factors, it was prime factors, B would be the correct answer. But because X and Y are themselves factors of each other, if the set of factors are identical, they must contain, their largest elements must be the same, which means they must be the same number, which is why C is the fully correct answer. And then we had 6 and 7, where in general you were able to count multiples fairly smoothly. A little bit more trouble with the first one, where there was a 7 in 35, and 100 of them in 56, and 4 of them in 7. But in general we were doing reasonably well. And then we had the, what is the problem with the proof? So, our first proof, okay? The problem is, as I say, the R is not covered by the theorem, okay? And so the problem here is that we assume the theorem is false. So we assume that there are natural numbers for which X is not equal to X plus 1. And we make the set of them that are false be B. Well, what is that set? That set is the entire set of natural numbers. So it does have a smallest element. The smallest element is 0. We'll call that K. 0 is in the set. Okay, but then when we try to create R equals K minus 1, that's negative 1, which is not in the set, not even in the scope of the theorem. So in this case, the problem with our proof is that we never verify that R is something for which the theorem ought to hold. The theorem is only stated to hold for natural numbers, not for all numbers. And so when we claim that it holds for R, we are wrong because the theorem does not apply in that case. When we switch it to integers instead, we have the problem that the well-ordering principle does not apply. Remember, the well-ordering principle says that any subset of the natural numbers has a minimum element. But there, the set of elements for which the set B is the set of all integers, which has no minimum element. So we can't even pick a K. There is no K that is the minimum element because the well-ordering principle does not apply to the set of integers. Any thoughts, comments, questions about the quiz? Okay. Let me also just review and make sure we don't have questions about sort of the logistics of our switching to online. If you are here listening to me, you presumably have figured out how lectures will work. And I welcome feedback about quality and approach here. I will also post a video afterwards, but if it turns out that a significant number of you are having real-time connection issues, we may switch to more modular, only pre-recorded things instead and try to adopt a different model of interaction. We'll sort of adapt our lab type activities for Fridays into just sort of working on practice problems and having some time for Q&A, but we won't do one-on-one help in labs anymore. Our in-class quizzes, the plan is, and this is all subject to adjustment, this is probably the one that has the most concerns raised so far. We will switch to OpenNote. I don't believe in making you sit right next to your notes and telling you not to use them with nobody watching you. That seems like a temptation that would be difficult to resist. So they will become OpenNote, but still do on your own. The main thing we're going to do to try to discourage sort of arbitrary investment is we're still going to limit them to a time window. So we've got two models. We will try one, and if that doesn't work well, we will try the other. The first model is there will be the question prompt will appear at a fixed time, the same time it normally does. So that would be 10:30 Eastern Daylight Time on a Friday. It will be due 20 minutes later. And the other model is there will be a window of time in which you can click a button to enable the quiz for yourself, and then you will have 20 minutes from that moment to submit it. We may bump that up to 30 if it turns out that the process of scanning your answers and so forth takes some time. The plan is that I'll just post the problem prompt, and you'll write on any arbitrary piece of paper your answer. Take a picture of that with your phone and upload it to the submission site, the same place you've been doing our progress tracking so far. And we may adjust that a little bit to see how it works if there's technical problems there. If you have no ability to take a picture, you don't have a camera or scanner or the like, please email me that personally as soon as you can so that we can find a different approach to do this. Question about this. Doesn't have to be a PDF or any file type. I have a question in the chat. It can be any file type that we can read. So an image would probably actually be preferred, although you're welcome to do a PDF instead if you have some mechanism for creating PDFs. Any other questions? Okay. The online quizzes were already online. They will still be online. Huzzah. Professor office hours. The current plan is that I will do them much like I did my real office hours. I left the door open, and if people walked in, they were in, no matter who that was. So here is the Zoom room that will be the effective version of my office. And during those times, anybody that comes in will come in and chat. I will be planning currently to use the same time for both of my classes. And so you may hear some questions from people in other situations. If you have personal things to talk with me, discuss and set up a time. We have another, can we have a practice test to get familiar with the uploading format? Yes, I am planning to do that probably Monday if I get my weekend working well, or Wednesday if not, to have just sort of a simple, can we get this to upload and see how well that works. All right. So that's professor office hours. TA office hours. Oh, we have another question. Two more questions. Will the quiz difficulty level be the same, even though it is OpenNote now? Yes, same difficulty. It will probably be slightly more different from the practice problems, so that there's less ability to simply copy the solution to the practice problems and change two words. But the difficulty is not intended to be harder. Will we get 30 minutes from the 10 to 10:30 to hold office hours? My tentative plan was to use that time instead for a sort of a full class Q&A and working some practice examples. But if we want to do sort of office hours there instead, we can certainly do that instead. And maybe I'll send out a poll to get some ideas about which one you would prefer. Will there be an out-of-class quiz this weekend? No. The only material I'd have to cover on that would be today's lecture, which will primarily, I assume, be logistics. So I don't have material to put on a quiz this weekend. Our next online quiz will be the following weekend. All right. So, TA office hours. We will see if this works. We've debated several different approaches. This is the one that I think will work reasonably well. We have an online office hour queue. And just to sort of show you what this looks like, let me go there. Oh, right, here I am as a TA. You can see, oh, we have two TAs online, right? So if you go to this place, it should authenticate you with NetBadge. And then you can, your view will allow you to say, I want help. And you will have previously gone to either moot.google.com or zoom.us and created a conference room space that you will put the URL of as the link for the TA to join. This will allow you to control that room, to share your screen, to upload files, to do whatever you want. The TAs can join you, talk with you, help you out as best they can. And then when they have resolved or given you some more to work on, they can go back out and help somebody else. This particular office hour queue, you may or may not have seen, depending on what earlier classes you've had. It is designed to live update. And you'll even see down here it says live updates enabled. So you shouldn't ever need to refresh it, reload it, or the like. It should tell you where your position is, if there are other people waiting for you, and so forth. Our hope is this will work well. We will also, of course, still continue to use Piazza if you want sort of a more text-based approach. And if you have feedback about this not working well or other approaches that you found in other classes work well or so forth, feel free to share that with us and we will do our best to decide if the perceived benefit is worth the cost of switching. So there is that. There is a reasonable chance that we will change our office hour times depending on what things are, but for now we're going to leave them at the times they have right now. Are there changes in the format of the file exam? Date change, will it still replace those, quiz grade, format, etc. The plan is to leave it essentially unchanged, except it won't be in person anymore. So we will sort of use the same mechanism that we, by the end of the semester, have evolved to use for our in-class quiz replacement. Whether that is a fixed time window or you have a window in which to work on it, I'm not sure which one that will be, but it will still be split out by topics. You can take the topics you want. You can choose whether to upload your answers or not after you see what it is, and replacing grades. Okay. I should also note accommodations, grading, etc. I have high expectations that many of you will find transitioning from an in-person class that I have many years of experience teaching to an online class that I am doing for the first time. This will not be a smooth transition. We will do our best, but please feel free to reach out if there is anything concerning. Reach out personally via email, contact me in office hours, set up other private meetings. You're welcome to use the anonymous feedback tool in Colab or Piazza posts or the like, however you want to reach out to us about this. In general, I would encourage Piazza to be limited to course content, whereas sort of logistic kind of issues would be shared in other mediums. But if you think it applies to everyone, Piazza is a reasonable place to go as well. So, if anything is not going smoothly, please let me know as soon as you can, and I will see what I can do to figure out how to make that go smoother. I'm less confident in my ability to make that work, but we will all learn together because that is how we are doing this. Anything else you would like to know about the logistics of this switch in the course or the logistics of the course generally? Okay. So, let's get to some content. If you look at the schedule for today, you will see that we have today sequences. And you can read MCS chapter 4.2, but it's quite short, and so I rewrote that chapter with a little bit of extra information. And this literally has the full text of that section, as well as a few extra things. We'll try to introduce these ideas today and see how this goes. So, let me first begin by comparing sequences to sets. So we're going to start with a set. Hopefully you recall that a set is written with curly braces, and it does not contain duplicates or order. So the set 314 is the same state as the set 134, and it does not make sense to try to put the one twice or the like. Okay? So they are unordered, and they have no duplicates. Both of these constraints can be dropped and create other mathematical structures. And so let's start with just briefly, we're hardly going to say anything about it, but except sort of letting you know that it exists and giving you the definition. There's a thing called a multiset. A multiset is also unordered, but it allows duplicates. And so a classic example of a multiset is the prime factors of a number, where, for example, the number 12 has the prime factor 2 with multiplicity 2. Multisets are traditionally written exactly like sets. Okay? And so they are unordered, but they allow duplicates, and the duplicates matter. And so this would be the same thing as this set, or this multiset. Okay, but the number of twos matters in this. Multisets exist. They're occasionally useful. There are a few multiset-like data structures that you'll learn about in data structure classes and so forth, but they're pretty uncommon in computing and computing-based math, and so we're not really going to say much more about them besides their existence. And the other one we're going to talk about here is sequences. They're not as common as sets, but they're common enough we're going to say a fair amount about them. Sequences are written with parentheses instead of curly braces. And they have the characteristic that they are ordered, that is to say, it matters what order things are on, and they allow duplicates. I should note that it doesn't make a lot of sense to have order or position in the sequence matter without allowing duplicates, because these two ones are in different places. They are therefore different in some important sense in the sequence. So there is not a commonly discussed thing that doesn't allow duplicates but does allow order. Instead, we have sets and sequences primarily, occasionally multi-sets along the way. And so this sequence is equal only to itself. This is not equal to the sequence 3, 1, 4. It is also not equal to the sequence 3, 1, 1, 4. Okay, these are different sequences. The order, the number of elements, what the elements are all part of the definition of a sequence. In that sense, it's somewhat like an array or a tuple or a list, depending on what programming languages you're most familiar with, that you will see in programming languages. There's a location for each value, as well as the values themselves. And that sort of suggests the reason why, one of the reasons why we care about sequences is because we have these ordered sequence data types inside our programming. And so we want to have a mathematical parallel of them so that we can talk about the behavior of those ordered data types when we are trying to prove things about our code. Sequences will also be useful because the most common model of computing, and the one you have all learned, I am sure, is a sequential model of programming, where one instruction runs, and then the next, and then the next. So we have this other sort of sequential ordered operations where operations can happen more than once. And so sequences will show up both to represent data and to represent process flow in our programs. And so they're going to be used a reasonable amount as we move forward. So this is the broad overview of the difference between sets, multisets, and sequences. Now, as we are dealing with sets, multisets, and sequences, let's note in particular about sequences. There are some special sequences. In particular, we're going to deal with the idea of a string quite often in computing. You've already learned strings in your programming classes. We're going to define them formally. A string is a sequence of symbols, where a symbol is a value with no properties. What do I mean by that? When we think about a value like 3, or the set 1, 2, or so on, these are values. However, these values have properties. They can be compared to other values. There are operators that work on them and so forth. They have meaning. And there is some specific differences between the value 3 and the value 4, between the set 1, 2 and the set 1. They have difference in meaning, and we can say things about their various cardinality, their various size, their various order, how they combine with operators, and so forth. But when we talk about symbols, all we have is that they are different. So we could, for example, decide we want one of our symbols to be a smiley face and one of them to be a square. Okay? These are symbols by themselves. I can't add them, I can't subtract them, I can't talk about their order, I can't do anything else with them except say they are distinct. They're either distinct or the same. So the only thing they have is identity. Symbols are used to represent a lot of different things as we turn the real world into math. So as we're trying to understand what is going on in our computer, we might actually have, for example, the amount of voltage on a wire. And if we were in electrical engineering class, we might care a lot about the characteristics of that voltage and the characteristics of that wire and have properties of that. But when we're trying to model it in computing, we generally want to abstract all of that away. And so we might deal with that voltage by saying there is the symbol 0 and the symbol 1 to represent two voltage states. And use that to try to converse about the behavior of that voltage in the wire without even entering into our mathematical abstraction any real information about voltage. By keeping the actual properties of what's going on out of our symbolization, we can avoid any risk that those implementation details will impact our end result. And so symbols are commonly useful as a way of sort of protecting ourselves, limiting what we're doing. When we have a sequence of symbols, we call that a string. Okay, so string is a sequence of symbols, that's what it means. And we will traditionally write it, instead of with parentheses, we'll traditionally write it with quotes, so that you know the things inside are symbols and they aren't intended to have meaning. So this string, okay, could be considered to be the same and is the same as the sequence consisting of those symbols. However, when I write the sequence of the symbols, it's harder for me to know that I mean the symbol numeral 3, or did I mean the numeric value represented by 3 most commonly when we write? And so to try to separate these, we will typically write these as if they were single instance strings, or single element sequences. Or sometimes we'll write them in a different typeface or the like, some way I'm trying to explicitly represent we mean only the symbol, the digit 4, not the concept, the number 4, as we're dealing. And so the most common way of representing sequences of symbols is as strings with quotes around them to suggest we mean only these symbols in this order, rather than the meaning contained within them. And you've already dealt with strings in other classes, and you'll deal with them more as you move forward. A great deal of theoretic computation is based on the analysis of strings, because it turns out we can use them to represent input and output very conveniently in our mathematics. And so they show up quite a bit as we move forward in trying to analyze what computers can do. Questions about sequences, symbols, strings, so far? Okay. Another thing we need to understand about sequences and sets is this idea of what we call the Cartesian product. The Cartesian product, named after René Descartes, who did a great deal of different things, most commonly represented as the idea of graphing functions. But he also came up with this special kind of product. The Cartesian product wants to have sets on both sides. And it results in a set of sequences. Okay? And the set of sequences is all those sequences we can create by taking an element of the right left-hand set first, an element of the right-hand set second. An element of the left-hand set first, an element of the right-hand set second, an element of the left-hand set first, an element of the right-hand set second. Okay? And we'll put all of those possible combinations, and that is the meaning of the Cartesian product. This Cartesian product is to some degree sort of the idea of we can take one set of numbers and another set of numbers and turn them into a set of coordinates. And so they're actually related to Descartes' work in graphing functions, this idea that you could take sort of the input and output of a function and graph it as a set of points. And so this is the concept behind it. Cartesian products are commonly used to try to explain what we mean by multi-input or multi-output functions and the possible space that can be dealt with them. And we'll see some more about that as we talk about function properties. We have a question, is that an X or a multiplication symbol? This is a multiplication symbol. It is the multiplication X. So it is not going to be a dot, it's never a dot. It's the X symbol that is the multiplication, not the letter. And I did not write multiplication correctly. So, we have a question. Is the Cartesian product commutative? That's a great question. Is it commutative? Is it associative? Take a moment. Think about this. Is this operation commutative? Is it associative? To get to associative, though, we have to actually say one more thing about... Well, no. We'll just have you think about this for a moment. And then we will try doing some sort of brief poll voting thing with Zoom. If you want to pick a friend that's also in Zoom and privately chat with them to converse on your answer, feel free to do that. And in a minute here, I will come and we will see what we think the answers are. All right, I just tried to make a Zoom poll, but it didn't work. So we will instead try the other way. If in Zoom you open the participants list, at the bottom of that, there should be an option more where you can put sort of various emotes next to what you are. And there is a thumbs up and a thumbs down emote. We're just going to see if we can do a quick poll here. Is the Cartesian product commutative? Thumbs up if you think it is, thumbs down if you don't. So we're getting several of both. But we're getting more thumbs up. We've also got a few yeses and nos, which I guess are also available here. Oh, we're having some people switch back and forth. But it looks like we're mostly saying no. Okay, that seems to be the predominant view. Let's see if we can back up this view. As a reminder, what it means to be commutative is that you can commute the operands to the other sides. And so if we take this example here, and we were to just try it in the other order. If we were to take 3, 4 times 1, 2, would that be the same set? And we will see that would have 3, 1, it would have 3, 2, it would have 4, 1, and it would have 4, 2. And if you look at those, there are no shared elements between these two sets, so they are not the same. Okay, and to understand that they're not the same, it's important to remember that the sequences have order. So 3, 1 is not the same as 1, 3. These are not the same value because the order matters. And because the order matters of these elements inside, even though the order inside the set doesn't matter, the order inside the sequences does. So while they're both sets of four elements, and while all of those elements are two-member sequences, they are different two-member sequences, and so it is not commutative. And now we get to associative. This one is less clear. Okay? Is A cross B cross C? If we write this in two ways, and we parenthesize it differently, do we get the same results? Let's again just take a poll. I haven't probably told you everything you need to know to answer this question, so we will come back to this, but I do want to serve your initial take. So you can use the thumbs up, thumb down, or the yes, no option. Let's take a quick poll here in the participants list. It looks like we are again mixed. But we are primarily thinking, well, we're a lot closer to even here, but we've got significantly more no's than yeses. So let's think about what it would mean, and let's start with just a very simple set, because I don't want to write out all of the versions. Let's just take this set containing 1, cross the set containing 1, cross the set containing 1. Okay? So if I do it this first way, this cross product, this Cartesian product, will be 1, 1, as its one entry. And then when I do this cross product, I would get 1, 1, 1. Get this correctly. Okay, and so you see I have a sequence of two elements, where the first element is a sequence of two elements, and the second element is one element. Whereas if I did it the other way, I would expect to have, if I had the set 1 crossed with the set 1 crossed with the set 1 with the other association, I would expect that to be the set containing 1 and 1, 1. And those look different. And here we come to one of the strange things about sequences. All right, I do have a question. I'll come back to that here in a moment. But I have a strange thing about sequences. The sequence 1, 1, 1, and the sequence 1, 1, 1. Sometimes we call them equal, and sometimes we call them not equal. And this is one of the annoying places where there is a lack of consistency in common practice. Okay, so it is common to see both versions of this in practice in the real world. Both the case where we consider them to be equal and the case where we consider them to be unequal. And usually you can't tell. When we are going to consider them equal, we will do something called flattening. Often we will assume you can flatten sequences, make a sequence of sequences into just a sequence. And this is commonly done when we're dealing with Cartesian products in particular, but sometimes it isn't. And so maybe yes, maybe no is this answer, which is a really annoying thing to have to say in a math class where we usually define terms crisply. Let's look briefly at the website where I tried to talk a little bit about this. This paragraph right here, let me zoom in here a bit. Sequences of sequences are sometimes flattened and sometimes preserved, generally with no explicit indication, which is done. Thus, the sequence 1, 2, 3 might be considered integral to 1, 2, 3 in some contexts and distinct from it in other contexts. As a rule of thumb, if the terms of the sequence are all of the same type, and the exact position of a term is less important than the overall sequence, they will be implicitly flattened. Note that both of those are dependent on context. You generally have to know from context whether we're going to be flattening or not flattening the sequences. So if we were in a flattening context, then we would say it is associative. If we're in a non-flattening context, we would say it is not associative. And how do you know which context you're in? You better hope somebody told you. So we have this challenge as we're going along to understand sequences that will sort of remain as we proceed and won't immediately go away. It will sort of stay as long as you deal with sequences. In any given context, there's generally sort of an understanding, but you sometimes will have to know from context which one you are. Looks like the question, we have a never mind, which means somebody figured out the answer, but doesn't mean everybody else did, so let's assume somebody else didn't. So we had this question about could we swap the order of numbers inside sets and make these look the same? And of course, sets are unordered. We certainly could have these in different orders, but what that would change is the order we enumerated these entries in, if I did the 2 before the 1, then I might do this sequence before that sequence, but I'd still have those two sequences as the individual that asked the question figured out, but just to make sure everybody else understands this as well, the question here is the order around the multiplication symbol rather than the question around inside the sets. So, I am sorry that the correct answer is I don't know if it's associative or not, because I don't know the context, but this is nonetheless how things work. Let's come and look at this, and we'll talk a little bit about sort of the formal definitions of something. So I have here a summary of sets, multi-sets, and sequences, which I will post on the website after this class, and some comments about them, right? Sets are orderless, have no duplicates, and are very common in computing. Multi-sets are orderless but do have duplicates, are rare in computing. Sequences are ordered, duplicates matter, and are common in computing, although not as common as sets. But we also have here a summary of this Cartesian product. First, I have a formal definition of the Cartesian product. Okay, the Cartesian product of sets A and B is the set of all sequences AB, such that A is an A and B is an B. Okay, and so we can write it cleanly and succinctly in our set builder notation. The most common interpretation of Cartesian product is that it is associative, and that it is flattening. So typically if you see A times B times C, what that means is sort of do them all at once. Make a set of all sequences of 3 elements. And if we had more, we would do a sequence of all 4 elements and so forth. Okay? And so we have this tradition that Cartesian product is defined to be associative, although in some contexts it might not be. But in general, that's sort of the default assumption. With this, we can also define powers. Just as a power in math, in sort of numbers, means multiply by itself a number of times, that's also what it means when we're dealing with Cartesian powers. A Cartesian power is a sequence of Cartesian, is a number of Cartesian products where all of the entries come from the same set. Okay? And so this idea of a Cartesian power is very commonly used to define sets of sequences where all elements of the sequence come from the same set. Okay, so in particular, if I were to consider the set, how about 0, 1, and I were to take that to the cubed power, this would be the set of all sequences of 3 zeros and ones. Okay, so in particular, it would have things like 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 0, and so forth. Okay, and so this concept of being able to create the set of all of the sequences whose entries come from a particular set and have a particular length using the product is commonly used to handle these sort of larger kinds of sets. sometimes we want to be able to talk about sets of sequences of all lengths. Okay? And so we also have this idea of what we call the clean star. Just as the Cartesian product is named after René Descartes, the clean star is named after a mathematician by the name of Kleene. I have forgotten his first name. Sorry about that. But the clean star is written as a superscripted asterisk. Always an asterisk, never a fancier star. It is an asterisk that gets in the superscript. Okay? And this means A to the zeroth unioned with A to the 1, unioned with A to the 2, unioned with A to the 3, unioned with forever. That is to say, it's a set of all sequences of any length where all of the elements of the sequence come from the set A. And so if we were to take the set 0, 1, the set containing 0, 1, and star that, this would be the set of all the sequences containing zero elements, the empty sequence, all of the sequences containing one element, of which there will be two, all of the sequences containing two elements, of which there will be four, all of the sequences containing three elements, and so forth, up for an arbitrary size. And so this is therefore the set of all sequences of zeros and ones of any length we might care to deal with. Given this, we can actually define the set of all strings in a programming language. If we were to define, and the most common symbol for this is sigma, if we define this to be the set of all characters that your programming language knows how to represent, then that sigma star is the set of all strings in the programming, the programming language can deal with. And so when you have said some variable has the data type string, you're implicitly saying it has a variable data type that is the program's representation of sigma star. It's the set of all possible strings that could exist. Just as when you make a variable whose data type is int, you're implicitly saying, I mean the integers, as many of them as the computer can represent. Is that not infinite is a question. This, yes, so it is absolutely the case that A star, the cardinality of A star is infinite, always infinite for any set A that has at least one element. And that is true, I should say that if the set A is greater than 1, that implies that it is greater than or equal to 1. That implies A star is an infinite set. Infinite sets are common, right? The set of integers is an infinite set. The set of natural numbers is an infinite set. The set of strings is an infinite set as well. A different infinite set for each potential alphabet. Is there any way to put bounds on A star? Bounds on A star. I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm guessing what you mean is, can I make a subset of A star where things are smaller? So let's just sort of, I'll show how we could do, I've got a correction, confirmation that is what is meant. Let's suppose I wanted to say the set of all strings whose length is not greater than 100. Well, that would be the set of all S, such that S is an element of sigma star, for whatever my sigma is, and then I just need to have one other constraint. I need the length of S to be less than or equal to my maximum thing. So let's just assume that length is the function that does that, and I can say that's less than 100. And so now I have created a set that is a subset of the set of all strings. In particular, it's a subset of strings that are small, smaller than some S. And this, therefore, has a finite cardinality, a very large cardinality, but a finite cardinality. Other questions? Okay. So we have sequences, we have clean stars, we have powers and products, and strings is a special example of sequences. we're not going to say, oh, try. In a programming language, is the set of all strings infinite then? Now, that's a good question. So, if I were, let's say I'm in Java and I make a string S, is the set of values I can give S finite or infinite? And the answer is, well, it's finite-ish. Okay? When programming languages need to run on computers, and computers have finite resources. And so the formal language will typically define this to allow it to be arbitrarily big. But the implementation of the language typically won't. Depending on exactly how strings are represented, exactly how memory is represented, this will vary. And so different programming languages will have different answers, but they will always end up being finite in practice because memory is finite. And you need to put it in memory. Maybe you don't need to put it in memory. Maybe you can put it on disk, but disk is also finite, much bigger. So it's always going to be finite. It's always going to, therefore, this, if we think about this, the data type string is going to be a subset of sigma star, okay? And it's going to be a finite subset, a proper subset, because it can't, in practice, deal with infinities. However, the goal is generally to support arbitrary value sizes. And so we try to make our implementation allow things to get big enough that the fact they can't be infinitely large doesn't matter. Other questions? Does cardinality apply to sequences since there are duplicates? That's a good question. A set has cardinality. Okay, a sequence has length instead. There are special cases where people will talk about the cardinality of particular elements of a set and so forth, but when we're thinking about sequences, what we're thinking about is their length rather than their cardinality. And in many contexts, you can just think of that as being a language-only difference. We're just calling it something different to represent the fact that one of them is well-defined when duplicates can't exist, and the other one is well-defined when they can and there's order. But this is a difference in terminology. In this class, we're going to represent cardinality with the absolute value sign. Whether or not length will be represented with the absolute value sign will differ by context, and we're not going to give a formal symbol for it in this class. So if we want to deal with the length of a sequence, we will either do some special function or use it out in words. What is being summed in sigma star? Yeah, that's an annoying thing. This is not a sum. It's the set of all characters, also called the alphabet. And the traditional symbol for this is a capital sigma. The traditional symbol for summation is also a capital sigma. Ah! You know, we have so many languages and so many letters, and we picked the same one for both. So when we have the sigma star here, we are dealing with the letter sigma, not the summation symbol. And sorry, they do look exactly the same, except the alphabet one is smaller. Any other questions? Okay. We are close enough to the end of class. I think we will stop introducing new things here. These ideas, we're going to end up using sequences and using some of these star and so forth ideas to create new concepts in weeks to come. I do have another question. Does the alphabet we're talking about just include the 26 ASCII letters or ASCII characters for sigma star? So this can vary by context. What the elements of this are, okay? So, for example, if I am writing in the C programming language, this will be the 8-bit extension of ASCII. It'll have 256 elements. If I'm writing in Fortran, it'll be the 7-bit version of ASCII. It'll have 127 elements. If I'm writing in Java, it'll be the 16-bit version of ASCII, and it'll have 64,000 elements. If I'm writing in a more modern language like JavaScript or D or so forth, it's going to have several million elements in it. And sometimes for mathematical contexts, we'll sometimes define explicitly an alphabet that just has a few symbols. But it's going to be all the symbols in use. So whatever the set of symbols are in the context we are dealing with, we will call the set of all the symbols in context sigma. Any other parting questions in our last 15 seconds? All right. Thank you all for joining, and I will be seen by you all on Monday.